Kelly, and I'm an alcoholic. I want to thank y'all for having me here. And I'm a little bit nervous. Just want to start off with my sobriety date is July the 4th, 1998. And through a loving God and this fellowship and good sponsorship and the steps, I've been able to not take a drink since that date. I want to get that out of the way. Have a home group. And for me, I need all of those things in order to stay right in the middle of Alcoholics Anonymous, which is, that's pretty much how I've been since I've been here. If I've done nothing else, I know I've done a lot of things wrong. I've suited up and showed up, and I've come to meetings, and I've tried to be of service to other people. And so I want to just get that out of the way. I'm supposed to share a little bit about what it used to be like for me when I was drinking, my experience of getting into AA, and what I'm like today. And I know that I have a problem. I have my problem centers in my mind today. It's not so much that I have a drinking problem today, but I still have living problems, living sober and behavior and different reactions and stuff. But before I go there, I'm originally from Hampton, Virginia. My dad's retired from the Air Force, and altogether I have six sisters, counting me as seven. And they divorced when I was really, really young, and I lived with my mom. And then she remarried a man that he's dead today, and I don't know if he was an alcoholic or not, but when they found him dead in his van, I guess it's been about 8 years ago, I knew he had tried VA and rehabs and things of that nature, and they found him dead in his van with all liquor bottles around him, and in his wallet was a Serenity prayer card. So I know he maybe at some point came in contact with somebody of us or whatever, I don't know. But growing up in that household at a very young age, long before I took a drink, I was in constant fear. 7, 8 years old. It was a lot of turmoil that went on in that home, and all of this that I'm sharing is not what makes me an alcoholic, but it was a lot of turmoil, a lot of arguing, a lot of coming in late drunk, a lot of confrontations with my mother, and, you know, we didn't have a phone, and my mom worked as a waitress a lot, and, you know, he'd be in and out and gone, but we just knew that whenever he came back to the house, it was going to be just a bad situation. And so, like, from 7, 8, 9, 10, I just wanted to be out of that house. I didn't want to be around him. Kind of really couldn't understand why my mother would keep putting up with that. So, I, you know, later on found out I had resentments against that. I mean, I've worked through that now. But I just knew that I couldn't wait to be able to get out of that house and no longer be there. And that was before I ever took a drink. I remember times, you know, like I had a cousin come spend the night, and I guess we may have been about 10 or 11 at this time, and he came in and did one of his episodes, and she got really scared, and, you know, she said, oh, she was down visiting from Lynchburg into Hampton. She had family in Hampton, and she said, I want to go and call my grandmother, and I want to leave. And I was like, her name was Vicky, and we were real close cousins, and I remember kind of like begging her not to go. I didn't want to be left alone there, and once again, he had ruined this spend-the-night thing over, and she was like, you know, I've got to go. So she went out the window to a 7-Eleven and called for someone to come and pick up her, and, you know, on the way, I asked her to call. I don't think it was 911 then. It might have been 0 for the police to come, you know, for my dad, and it just went on and on like that. And during that time, we would move a lot because my mom couldn't you know, she could pay the bills for a while, but then she'd get behind being as a waitress. And then I had two younger sisters that was by this marriage, and they were very small, and they would go to babysitters. And around 11 or 12, you know, they went to babysitters, and she would work double shifts at banquets and stuff, and just tried to hold us kids together. And at that point, I just started being very, very rebellious. I didn't want to go to school. We lived on like a cul-de-sac, and at the end of that cul-de-sac was a bunch of woods. And you'd see these older kids coming out of the woods, and you just knew something was going on back there. And I just wanted to know what was going on back there. And back then you had like foosball parlors where you could go and play foosball and pool, and they didn't serve alcohol, but you know, you could go. And I used to start going, you know, skipping school and going in those places and smoking cigarettes. And my one of my younger sisters had to come by this place on the bus and seen my bike there, went home, called my mom. She came up with a switch, because back then you got the switch. And I'm smoking a cigarette and playing foosball and looking cool, and in comes my mom. I drop the cigarette on the ground in the carpet, and she's telling this guy up there, this big hippie-type guy, blah, 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 about my daughter, and pretty much whipped me all the way home. And it just started being, you know, one year I went to school. We moved up here. My mother's from Lynchburg. And so when these fights and arguments would go on, we would move to Lynchburg. And when I was in the fourth grade, I went to four different schools in that year. And being a new kid at school is tough anyway. And when you're already insecure because you don't have the right clothes, people make fun of you. You don't, you know. I just felt like that I didn't fit in, and it was just kind of a rough place to be. And then we'd go back to him, and it was just, I just couldn't wait to get out of that house. So when I was in the sixth grade, 12 going on 13, I can't remember. Back then, middle school was sixth, seventh, and eighth grade. And these kids at school, these older kids, I think they were in, you know, like maybe the ninth grade or whatever they were in, I don't know, invited me and another girl to go out to these woods, because the school I went to was on the other side of the woods. And I was always interested, and but I was younger, you know. And so they invited us to go back there, and it was three other guys and two of us, and they had stolen some, that I don't know if they still do or not, but like the drugstore sold wine in cases in a drugstore. And they had went up to some drugstore at a shopping center and bought like four bottles of Mad Dog 2020 and Boone's Farm, I believe it was. And we stood around in a circle, and I had never drank that I can remember up to that point. Maybe I took a sip off of a beer, or I can remember my dad going out to the NCO club and he drank these grasshoppers or something after dinner drink, and he'd like let me have a sip. I'm not going to say I never tasted alcohol, but this was the first day that I really. So they passed this wine around in the circle, and when it got to me, it was no thinking about it, or I kind of, even with food, will kind of sniff something before I taste it or drink it, and it was none of that going on. They handed it to me, and I just started drinking it, and I guzzled it, and on a sip, and the young guy, I can't remember his name now, but he took the bottle away from me, and he said, "You go steal your own." And so, I mean, I got that day going home. No, we never did. This was anyway during the school year, and we had left at lunchtime and went to these woods. And of course, we didn't go back to class. And we went up and got more wine. And that night, I came home with, I was drunk, had a hickey on my neck, and had smoked some other stuff. All of this new stuff all happened in this one night. And I just can remember, though, like it was yesterday, just feeling warm inside. Just that scared, uneasy, awkward, you're not a part of, inferiority, insecurity, whatever the words, they weren't there for that short period of time. and I was laughing, and I had a good time, and I wasn't even scared to go home. And it was like about 9 o'clock at night, and I hadn't been home from school or anything, and I figured I'd. Well, I didn't figure my stepfather, was going to be there. I figured he'd be gone, and Mother would have been working, and the kids would have been at the babysitter, but they were all there. And so I went into the house and proceeded to get sick, and was so sick hanging over that toilet, and it was nothing but red from the Mad Dog 2020. I was just so, so sick. And just swore up and down, oh, Lord, I'll never do that. And they asked me my mom asked me what was wrong with me. And I told her I just must have had ate something bad. And my stepfather's going, and she ain't ate nothing bad. She's drunk. Can't you see it? And look at what's on her neck. And my mom asked me how that happened. And I said, when I was riding the bike home, because I had a bike that I rode to school, I fell over in the rose bush, and it stuck me there. My mom believed all of that. My stepfather won't have it, none of it. But I guess because I was so sick, you know, and he wasn't drunk that night that I can remember, that nothing, I mean, I didn't really suffer any consequences that night. I just went on to bed, and he was, you know, yelling at my mom and telling her all this stuff. And I remember it was on a Wednesday, and I didn't go to school on Thursday because I was so sick. But by the end of Thursday, I could not wait to get back to that school to get with them people. I don't know if it was so much I couldn't wait to drink again. I mean, I don't know. Maybe it was. I don't know. But I couldn't wait to get back with those people again because I had finally found my crowd and felt accepted and good. And I don't know if it was the alcohol or just the acceptance or that came along with the part of it or whatever. I don't know. But I knew I couldn't wait. And that started, you know, that started many things from there. Just started staying out late, started staying out all night long. My mom and him were still having troubles. She'd move up and down the road. And one year I moved over and lived with my dad. I think I was in the seventh grade then. And my dad was very strict. You were in by 9 o'clock at night, and if you did stuff, you got put on restriction, and it won't no running wild, and it won't like what I was used to be, you know, to doing. And I couldn't stand it over there, and I couldn't stand my stepmother. And this time I had twin sisters that was 5 years old. The oldest sister was gone off to VCU, and my dad was in the hospital with a slip disc in his back. And this woman was going somewhere, and I was having to watch these kids every Monday, Tuesday, and Friday. And I hated that. And I got so just, you know, because it was all of the thing of she broke my parents up and all of this crap. And here you got this 14-year-old that's already experienced alcohol and everything else and used to running wild. And now you got her in this environment where she's got to go to school every day or be on restriction and all of these rules. And it was just, I know I was like a tornado in chaos running through their house. And I know she could not wait to get rid of me, and I could not wait to get rid of the end in that school year and getting back to my dad's. But anyway, through this period of time, this woman was going somewhere, and I was still, you know, they had alcohol in the house, and I would sneak drinks and do all of that. And he was in the hospital, and I, you know, out of my selfishness and self-centeredness and just who I was at the time, I called him up and I told him, I said, I don't know where your wife is going on such and such a night, but I'm tired of watching these brats, and I'm tired of being in this house, and she's probably screwing around on you. And I'm just saying all this stuff to my dad laying in the hospital, and the man never said anything. He just said, she'll be on home in a little while, don't leave the kids, you know. He never said anything. And so I just made their life really, really, really bad during that year. And I was a thief, and I would look through your things and do stuff. So I was looking through her things one day in this lingerie drawer, and I came across this big, big book of Alcoholics Anonymous laid up underneath some of her clothes. And I didn't know what it was, and I didn't even open it up to read it. I just seen this book. And, I mean, who would have ever thought that maybe one day I would come to maybe need that book or whatever? I mean, I don't know, but I believe something happened something has happened along the way to get me to where I'm at today. So anyway, since then and talking with her, that was her second or third year of sobriety. And she was going to meetings on those nights that I, you know, said all that stuff and everything. So anyway, the end of that school year, I stayed on restriction all the time. I mean, I stayed on restriction. It was terrible. And that last year, the only thing that I liked to do was just, my thing was going to the skating rink. And I loved to skate and the all-night skating parties. And I was involved in like a speed team type of thing, racing and skating. And I remember I wanted these skates really, really bad. And my dad said, no, I'm not going to buy them for you because your foot hasn't quit growing. So I didn't get the skates and whatever. You know, the end of the year came, I went back with my mom. And I went back with my mom. We moved up to Lynchburg. I moved up to Lynchburg. During this period of time when I wouldn't go to school back then, they had truant officers, you know, and they would always come by the house and want to pick me up, and I'd always been drinking, doing something. I was just self-will run riot, and I had the attitude of that the world had dealt me a bad hand, and I was going to get you before you got me type of thing. And I didn't want to work, and I didn't want to do anything, and it's just, I'm just surprised that I'm standing here alive today. And I'm not going to go through all that, because I just want to talk in a general way and get to recovery. But I would hitchhike rides, you know, I would go off with somebody at a drop of a hat for a drink or other things. I mean, it just didn't matter. And have just come so close in so many situations of, really shouldn't be here. And anyway, during this school process, when you didn't go to school, the truant officers come and got you, and I got put on probation for being like getting charged with delinquency, being a minor and all of that. So I spent some time up here in Bon Air in Richmond, and then I got to go back home after then and try it again, and two or three halfway houses. And all of this is going on like at 15, 16 years old. You know, I would steal money from my mom. At this point, I'm not having nothing to do with my dad at all. I come up to Lynchburg. Well, before I got to Lynchburg at 18, and I lived up here for a few years, I was hanging around with a lot of Navy people down in Norfolk. And at this time, I'm staying here and there because my mom just had pretty much given up. My dad had pretty much given up. I had quit school. My mom was having too much going on. My dad won't have nothing to do with me. And I could always make up an excuse that I was staying at so-and-so's house or I'm over here. And my mom just went along with it. And so I stayed down there when she moved up here and started hanging out with a bunch of people and going to after-hour bars and hanging out with people older than me, fake IDs in the bar and everything. And excuse me. And me and some girls, you know, we would meet some of these Navy guys, and they'd buy us drinks, and they would think that they were going to get other things, and we would, you know, get them over to a hotel or something, and then some other guys that would be with us would mug them and take the money. And just all kinds of things like that went on. And being in this program now, I have a way of paying that money back. After getting into AA and going through the steps, I'm making amends on that. I just did a lot of things out there and just, you know, didn't want to work for it. So anyway, I ended up getting pregnant at 18 years old. And I thought, this will be all right. This guy will marry me and everything will be okay. And that isn't the way it happened at all. At this point, I met him here in Lynchburg, and then I moved back to Hampton. And I'm starting this cycle that my mom's done. And I didn't want to raise my son like that. I lived down there with him till he was 5 years old. And this is what I did. I stayed on welfare. I lived in low-income housing. I work at as a bartender on the side. I'd go out with people that had money, and I would just do in and everything. Well, I got into some other stuff, would stay out all night long and sleep all day, and my mom would have to take care of my son, and so I knew he was going to be, starting school, you know, and I wanted to make a different life, and I didn't want him to grow up like I was, and I didn't want him to have to go to different schools, so I moved to Lynchburg. Well, they still have bars in Lynchburg. The streets roll up a little bit early, but, you know, I take me with me wherever I'm at, and I'm going to find those kind of people, you know, if I'm still doing those same things. So, moved up to Lynchburg, and it was really kind of a big change. I went from disco duck bunny to country music, shooting pool, and honky-tonk bars, and all of that, and just doing the same thing, drinking, driving. I've had 5 DUIs. I've been convicted of 3. I've been convicted of bad checks. I've been convicted of, well, I've been arrested 27 times for different things. I'll just put it to you like that, and you know, and I would go through the VASAP class, and I'd get a weekend in jail, and I'd do this, and I'd get 2 weekends in jail, and I was always going to just make sure that my son, I felt like he was the only thing permanent in my life and that I had, and I was just going to make sure that I took care of him, and that he'd go to the same schools, and that he would have the clothes and the things that he needed. And he did, but the things that I did to get them weren't exactly, you know, it wasn't because I worked for him. And so I'm in this process of just, my kid, I think the only thing that pretty much saved him, and I want to say thank you because it may have been some of you men or some other men, but, you know, I was a single parent up until he was 18. But he always had something to do after school. He was in scouts, he was in soccer, he was in karate. And there was these male mentors in his life that had good values or morals or whatever they had. And I don't know, because I would take him to these things, but then I would go to happy hour. And then he'd wait for me to come pick him up, and I'd call and say, you know, I'll be there in an hour or a few minutes, I'm on the way. And then he knew where I was, and he called the bar. You know, he had the bar numbers by this time. And finally, you know, other people's parents was having to bring him home and stuff. And to the best of my knowledge, to this day, none of those people talked bad about me to him or ridiculed him. They just gave him a ride. They did what they needed to do, and I really appreciate that. So anyway, speeding on up, you know, I've always bartended, and you know, I've always drove whether I'm supposed to drive or not. I go to North Carolina, and I get a driver's license down there, and they use a different number, or they did. I don't think they do that anymore, but I would drive on North Carolina driver's license, and I'd still go through road checks, and they'd see me in this car, and I'd say, well, I'm going to college, or I'm doing something, and finally, you know, they're like, you got to get these tags registered, and all of that stuff was just coming down. It was just like everything was just, you know, I would come home at night and drunk, hungover, and go to bed, and I would cry, and I would ask God, you know, would you just please put someone decent in my life to love me for me, and can you help me hold a job, because I never could hold a job. I was good at getting jobs, you know, but if I went out and started drinking, there went the job, because I stayed out all night long, and then I couldn't get up the next day. And I remember my son telling my mom one time, I worked at this car lot, and I'd worked there maybe, I don't know, a month or two, whatever it was, and sold a few vehicles. And I remember my son, he might have been, I don't know, 14 or 15 at the time, telling my mom when she visited how nice his mom looked, and he was so glad she was getting up and going to work. And then, you know, the very next day, I don't go to work. My son would get himself off to school. He was good about going to school. He was good about going to bed. And just, anyway, I just, I guess I don't know the word for it. I just didn't feel worthy. I was so down on myself. I didn't have a trade. I really didn't think that I could do anything, you know, other than maybe bartend, wait tables or, you know, have boyfriends and just live off of the system, and got caught for welfare fraud. That was one of the charges, had to pay back stuff. I mean, I'm very lucky that I'm not sitting in the penitentiary today. I got involved with a married man, and he bought this house, and he had plenty of alcohol and everything, and all I needed to do was stay at this house, and everything was, you know, I could do whatever. And one morning I got a call, and I need to really share this because I'm so greedy, and I don't want to do nothing for nothing, that this is how it went. He called one morning. He was a businessman. He asked me to meet him. I went to meet him downtown. And the next thing I knew, we were down in downtown Lynchburg across the railroad tracks where the foundry is, Lynchburg Foundry is, and there's the James River. And this is about 9:15. I've just dropped my son off at school. And as we're getting around there, he just took my head and started beating it into the dash. And my wife knows, and why did you leave that note? And just started going off, and I didn't know what he was talking about. I, honest to God, didn't know what he was talking about. And we get down there. People are going to work across these railroad tracks. We're standing outside of the car, and the guy is pointing a gun at me at 9:30 in the morning. And I am literally, like, begging on my knees for my life. And I said, please, I got a son. He said, I don't give a shit about your son, excuse me. He said, but I got two kids, too. And he said, my daughter got a note off of my windshield this morning and took it to my wife, and she's leaving, and it had your name on it. And I, honest to God, didn't do it. And so we just went through that, and you know, he kept kicking me and doing stuff, and none of these cars are stopping. And finally, he just looked down at me as he pointed that, and he said, you know, you're not worth killing. He said, go and walk up to the police station. It'll be the last walk that you ever make. And he left. And there I was, you know, doubling over. I get myself up, and I'm trying to wave down somebody because my car is up on Main Street. And this man stopped and gave me a ride, and he said, I don't want no trouble, lady, just let me drop you off, and he did, and that's a whole story in itself. I went to the hospital, the detectives come, they knew he was the one that did it, I wouldn't admit to it, and all of this stuff, and stayed at my aunt's for a couple of weeks because I was scared to go back to the house, but then I went back to the house because it was free. I knew I wasn't going to have to pay anything, and I knew I could hold this over top of his head, and so I did that. Well, I want to hurry up with this, but he got in some trouble about 2 years later, the same thing, holding his housekeeper up at gunpoint with another young woman he had been fooling with, but this time that woman took charges out. And these detectives came back, you know, and I'm still living there for free, getting money, getting my alcohol and other things. Not, you know, just putting out of the mind, you know, what had happened to me. Because I'm greedy, and because I don't want to work for a living, and because I think you owe me something. And so they came around and started asking me about this man and what he had done at this housekeeper and what I testified and blah, 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 blah. And I was like, I don't know what you're talking about. I'm not going to do it. And he said, you know, we know what happened, and, you know, please come and, you know, and about 2 days after then, he stopped by with tears in his eyes, and he said, you know, I was never going to hurt you that day. And he said, please don't go and testify or anything. And my brain was just going, and I said, you know what, if you sign this house over in my name, you ain't got nothing to worry about. And he didn't sign the whole thing over, but he did put me on the deed. I mean, that's just, you know, that woman could have lost her life or just anything. And I'm still doing all of this because I don't want to work. Because, you know, you did this to me and you owe this to me. This is my house. That's the least that I deserve. Well, my first sponsor in Alcoholics Anonymous told me, you don't deserve nothing. You're just lucky you got to live there for 13 years free. He don't owe you anything. And as time went on, after I got in this program, which I'm jumping ahead, I signed the lien over to him, and I didn't ask for anything. And for somebody that's greedy as me to be able to do that, as bad as I hated to do that, I had to do that because I was getting ready, and I know I'm jumping forward, and I know I'm jumping forward, but I was getting ready to start my life with a man that really loved me, and I could not start out on a lie like that. But I thought that I deserved at least half of the money. And the sponsor I had at that time said, you don't deserve any money. And it was just like even my lawyer couldn't believe it. But I'm glad that I did that because who knows, that I might have could have got drunk over that again one day. You know, I don't know. But that was later. So, you know, I'm just telling you the kind of person I am. You know, I feed off of people. I take what I want. I take advantage of people. I took advantage of my family. I've taken advantage of my son. I always thought I was hurting myself. And all these times I'd go to jail, my poor son would get a friend of his that worked with him at Chick-fil-A to come and pick me up out of the jail or to get the car. And these boys, I don't know, my son's never said, but they never ridiculed him. They just did whatever. And anyway, at the end of my drinking, I worked at the Elks Lodge and I was a bartender. And they didn't care if you had a drink. As long as you didn't get out the way, you could have a drink behind the counter. And people would come in and play cards and things of that nature. And before this last bottom or whatever, this man came in and he must have noticed something. I noticed he always drank Cokes, but he played cards. And he come up to me one night and he said, Kelly, he said, just out of the blue when I was cashing in chips, he said, you know, me and my wife would love to take you to a meeting sometime if you'd like to go. And I said, a meeting? He said, yeah. He said, I go to some of those AA meetings. And I said, well, I don't think I'm bad enough for that yet. And he said, well, what, you know, if you ever. So that was like during the Christmas time. And at this point, the man I'm married to now, I was dating. I would get up in the morning and drink Red Eyes. And by 12 o'clock, I'd go to some bar or something on the way to work because I was a nighttime manager there. I had to be there at 5. And I'd have like White Zinfandel or wine somewhere at Charlie's thinking I'm having lunch. I'm really having the wine. And then I get to work. And after about an hour or so at being at work and all the other, you know, heads would leave and stuff, then I would start drinking vodka and tequila. And I never really got out of the way, but I got, you know, I got a good buzz going on, and they definitely got good drinks, and they liked me. And so one night, you know, at this point, this was in January of 97. I'm on probation for bad checks. I didn't tell y'all that whole deal, but they wanted to give me 7 years, and they suspended it and put me on 18 months of probation. And I had been the 5 DUIs, but I'd been convicted of 3. And I'm still driving this car, and I'm still working as a bartender, and I'm still drinking. And one night, me and this man, I had fixed dinner, and I had asked him to come over. And before he came over and I got off from work, I had sat there and had a couple drinks. And it went like this. There was another gentleman that knew my husband today that knew the woman that he used to date many years ago. We were talking many years ago, and he was telling me about her and everything. And so I have those drinks. I leave. I go and work out at a gym. I come home. I fix this spaghetti meal. He comes in, and I start asking him about so-and-so. He said, I've already talked to you about this person, you know, and I'm just not going to listen to it tonight. I can tell you've been drinking. And he said, I'm just going to go on home. And I said, well, what about the meal and everything? He said, I don't care about the meal. He said, Kelly, I just want to go on home. I don't want to hear it tonight. So he left, and there I was with sweatpants on, a workout top, and this is like January, I think it's the 27th, and I'm thinking, I'll fix you. So I get in the car. I go pick up a friend. Neither one of us got a license. And we go out to another bar, and there I am, shooting pool, hair in a ponytail, thinking I'm looking good, damn midriff, and just, I drink a $68 bar bill, stayed till 2 o'clock in the morning. That was Tequila Shooters and Coors Light. I can remember it like yesterday. And when closing time come, I thought, I wonder what he's doing at his house, and I wonder who's over there, because there's somebody over there. So I leave this place, and the other person, I don't know what happened to them, but they was gone. So I get back in the car, and I leave, and I go down to where he lives in this townhouse, and there's nobody there. The lights are all off. You know, he's done went on to bed, you know, and I come on back, and I come on down Lakeside Drive, and as I come down Lakeside Drive, here comes the cop. Well, reality set in really, really quick. And I mean, I sobered up quick, and I thought, oh my God, this is it. I mean, this is really it. You're on probation, you can't do nothing, 7 years hanging, and here comes this cop, and I think, if I can get down to the quickie store and get out of the car, he can't get me for drinking and driving. So I'm, you know, it's less than a half a mile, and I get down there, and I get out of the car, and I'm walking in the quickie store, and he taps me on the back of the shoulder and asks me to step over, puts me in the back of the car, and I walk the line again, and I told him, look, I can't afford to be in no trouble. I said, I really can't. I was crying, and I was like, you know, my whole life was flashing before my eyes at this point. I mean, this was it. And I said, look, I said, can't we work this out? You know, we can just do whatever you want to do. We can just work this out. And he said, Miss Perry, if you don't shut up, I'm going to write you up for something else. And I started crying even more. So, same thing. Go on downtown. My son come and got me at 7 o'clock that morning. And they let him get the car out, and a friend of his brought him. And, you know, I know that things are really bad now, because I'm in violation, probation, and, you know, and I was real good at hiding things. My son knew about a DUI, and he knew about, but he didn't know how bad, he didn't know how serious. My aunt and stuff, when I'd have to go to jail on these little trips, would watch him and take care of him, and we just kind of kept it. And when I got in that house that morning, and this is where, you know, the first step is, I was not surrendered that day, but I got in that house that morning, and I drank till whatever time, 2 o'clock, and then went to jail, and he got me about 7:30. When I got in that house, I needed a drink so desperately. I was shaking. I physically needed a drink. I needed it. And I had about that much wine in the refrigerator, and I went straight to the refrigerator and got it and turned it up. And my son stood at the front door because he's going on to school, and he just looked at me and just had this look. He said, what are you doing? I just come and got you. And I said, don't worry, Ryan. Everything's going to be all right. I had the phone book out, and I'm looking for these numbers and lawyers and drinking this thing. And he just had this look, and I said, it's all going to work out. I just got to, you know. And he just shook his head and went out the door. And I thought, what is wrong with me? You know, what is wrong with me? Well, I know now today that I was drinking because, number one, I had that physical craving. That alcohol was not out of my system. You know, and I needed a drink, you know. And then, of course, once I had that drink, then the obsession of the mind came over. And in order to figure out what I'm going to do and get out of this trouble, you know, it was just insane. And I went on back to work at the Oaks Lodge. My probation officer told me unless I was found guilty, he would not violate me. He would wait till the court date. And I went on back to work at that Oaks Lodge. And I still drank for about 2 more weeks there. I still drank, and I still, you know, was the same person. And then I got fired from there because I ran my mouth to this boss that was a man. And the Elks Lodge is a men's organization, pretty much. And here this bartender is just, you know. So I get fired from there. And I get this lawyer, you know, and he's not telling me anything. And it's just really, really bad stuff. And the last night that I got fired at the Elks Lodge, I remembered what that guy told me about carrying me to a meeting. And my mind started working, but it was manipulative, and the motive was wrong, and I had a drink in hand before I closed up. And I thought, I'll call these AA people. Maybe they can help me out. Maybe they can tell me something or go to the judge or whatever. You know, I'm in trouble now. And so I've got this vodka and cranberry juice going, and I'm drunk, and I called this woman, and she had the worst voice. It was a southern country whiny voice, and she just went on, and I was asking her, could she help me? And she said, if you feel the same way in the morning, I'll come take you to a meeting. And the meeting was like at 9:30 down on Church Street in Lynchburg. And so the next morning, I came to or woke up, it was 9:15, and I was nine. And I was so sick, and I was so scared and so shaky and just at my wit's end. I said, but I got to call this woman because I'm going to get to this meeting because they're going to help me out, you know. It wasn't about quitting drinking. It was just, how do I drink successfully without suffering the consequences and these people helping me out in court? That's what it was about. But today I believe I don't care how you get here. As long as you get here, you find out you're one of us and you stay. Because not everybody comes surrendered. I did not come surrendered. So, got down there, and she come and picked me up, and we went down on Church Street next to the Salvation Army building, and there's all these people out there, and I'm thinking, oh, God, and she talked to me the whole time, telling me what I was going to have to lose in order to gain, and I'm going to jail and this and that. And she was just as happy, and, well, you know, if you have to, and blah, and I was like, look, I don't have to do anything but just get out of this trouble. You know, and we get down there, and there was these three guys. They're still sober today, and they were hanging outside. And I know today one of them had about 6 months. One of them had a year. I don't know what the other one had, but he was a fruitcake with them. But those three guys, when I got out of the car, this woman introduced me to them, and we smoked a cigarette because we had time. And I was just shaking. And they extended their hand to me. And, I mean, these were burly guys. One was a biker, and the other one was like a Skid Row guy, and the other one was just, I can't explain him. But in their own way, they were trying to extend their hand to me. And they said, you know, come on inside. Let's get a cup of coffee. You know, everything's going to end up being all right. You're in the right place. I don't know what all they said. So we went on inside. And we sat down at these tables in there, and all I can explain to you is at that first meeting, I wasn't surrendered. I don't know what all they shared about, but I let out a breath that seemed to last for that whole hour. And all I can describe, the feeling of it was that I was safe. Like, just for 1 hour, I'm safe. And I just felt safe, you know, and I know I cried through the whole meeting, and it was like I didn't even want to leave that room. I just felt safe. And I'm glad that everybody that was at that meeting didn't need a meeting that day, that for whatever reason people extended their hand, they helped me. I never want to forget, you know, I just never want to forget how they made me feel at that meeting. And, you know, for anybody that comes to my home group, I want them to feel like that, that they're welcomed, that they're safe, that there's a solution here. And, you know, at the end of that meeting, you know, this woman asked me, did I want to go to another one that night? I didn't want to go to another one that night, but I was at this point where I was too scared to be by myself. I was in so much trouble. I didn't know what I wanted. I just knew that I didn't want anything to get any worse. And so I went to another meeting with her that night. And, you know, basically for almost 2 years in AA, 15 months, a year and a half, 2 years, all I did was I did not drink, and I went to a meeting. And I got a coffee-making job. They gave me a coffee-making job in that home group, which in my mind, I didn't know it, but a lot of times that coffee-making job got me off the couch on Friday night to the meeting because I really didn't know that anybody else had a key. And I thought, God, if I don't make the coffee, then it's not going to get opened up. And then how would that look? Because, you know, it's all about how I look and what I'm trying to do. And, you know, so I made the coffee. You know, I know today there other members had a key there. The coffee would have got made. It would have went on without me. But I didn't know that then, and thank God. You know, had some bad behaviors. You know, my first good while in AA was sitting on my hands in a seat. I couldn't sit still. And when you talked about God, you know, I had so much guilt and shame, I couldn't stand that. I'd leave the meeting. And people would just tell me, it's okay, come on back. You know, they would just, I can't explain it, but they were just there for me. They never give up on me. No matter what I did, and I've done some, I've done some outrageous things, a lot of times just to get your attention. And they'd just smile and, you know, they'd just tell me to come on back. And so anyway, I ended up getting a sponsor and started going around to these functions with different ones, went to court. I didn't get the penitentiary time. I did get 4 months in jail. I went to jail. I want to hurry up here. I went to jail for 4 months. My son graduated from EC Glass like June the 14th, and I wasn't due to get out of there until the end of June. And they give me a furlough to go to his graduation. They let me get out at 5 and go to his graduation and be back at 9. And, I mean, that's God. Because there are people that I know today, I carry meetings into jail, and a lot of them don't even get to get out to go to a family's funeral unless it's the immediate mother or father or whatever. And I know that that's not nothing due to what I did. I know that that judge knew he was from a single family home and probably needed his parent there. Not because I was so good and deserved to go there or anything. And anyway, like about 3 days before I went to court, people kept, you know, telling me, you better tell your son about what's going on. You don't know what's going to happen, you know. And so I come clean and I told him. I said, I don't know what's going to happen to me on Friday. You know, this, that, and the other. And he had this look, and he didn't realize how serious it was. And I think one of my big surrenders was, you know, I thought I had lost everything in my life, and everybody was pretty much against me but this boy. I mean, he was never going to leave or be right there. And I remember telling him, you know, Ryan, I don't know what's going to happen on Friday, but if I have to stay somewhere, will you come and see me? And he looked me dead in my eyes, and he said, Mama, he said, I don't know. He said, I got to go do what I got to do for me, and you got to go do what you got to do for you. And he walked out that house. And I know I'm kind of going all around here, but when he walked out of that house, something happened to me so deep inside of me that I knew I was on my own. Like, this is it, and you are really on your own. And there is nobody left now. There is nobody left. And I, like I said, been coming to AA. And the only thing I felt like Bill describes in the book, that quicksand stretched all around me. I felt like I was choking, that there was no way out. It was just like, I had all this stuff in my mind that I'll run, I'll do this, I'll do that. And at the same time, I just dropped to my knees next to my sofa. And all I said was, God, help me. No long out, drawn out prayer, no this, that, and the other. I just asked for help. And when I got up and the car was out there and I could have went and done, I went to the telephone and I picked it up and I called this girl that had been taking me to meetings and everything, and she came over and sat with me till about 4 that morning. And that was the first night that I didn't have to take a drink when I so desperately wanted one, craved one in my mind, you know. And it was all right, and I got through that first night. And I went to jail, and that was like the end of June, and I went to Myrtle Beach, and the heat got off, and I got out of jail, and I went to Myrtle Beach 4th of July weekend. And my husband now didn't realize about all of this not drinking, and he had a couple beers on the beach, and he asked me if I wanted one, and so I drank. And the reason, and I was serious when I surrendered in my house, but I didn't have a solution. And so because my ego rebuilt and the heat's off and I'm not in trouble, and you hand me a beer, you know, and I don't know the difference, I took it. So I drank 2 beers there. We came back home. I went to shoot pool in a tournament on a Sunday night, and before I knew it, I was on my 4th beer sitting at the bar. And but I didn't finish that 4th beer. Something clicked in, and I had a realization that here you are. You've been given another chance. You didn't get all that time, you know. And I pushed it away, and I walked home. Thank God the craving or the obsession of the mind or whatever didn't take over me so deep that I didn't continue on. I don't know why. But I walked from that Allied sandwich shop 5 blocks home, and I cried all the way home, and I knew I was done, and I knew what it meant to be powerless over alcohol and drinking what I didn't want to drink. I knew that, and I went back to my home group and picked up my chip, and that's why that's my sobriety date. Like I said, I got a sponsor. I got a sponsor that believes in the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, and it's not about what you say here and about what you quote here, but it's about what you do here. And, you know, and this person would be outside of the meetings all the time. What step are you on? What are you doing? What action are you taking? I got so sick of that, I couldn't stand it. And, you know, it came a point in my life that, I mean, I was going to meetings and going to AA functions, and I was feeling good, but something wasn't right. I had so much anger in me. Just, I was ready to burst at the seams, you know. And because of my mind thinks what all of this stuff means when I don't know what it means. And I still don't know what it means today. And that's okay. A lady just now told me a couple of days ago that it is okay for you to say that you don't know. It is okay, because once you think you know, and you say you know, then you're in a lot of trouble. So I don't know. What I know is this man took me through the steps. He was married, strictly platonic. I wrote down the fourth step. I was able to get out some stuff. I was able to make some amends. I'm still making some. And in this whole process, I go to jail meetings. Today, I'm running out of time, so I keep going to AA. I try to go to solution-oriented meetings. I try to carry the message to other women. I go to jail meetings, something that I never thought that I would do. But I'm going to tell you something that's real recent, but it was the best thing that could have happened to me last Wednesday night of going to this woman's jail meeting. Because I'm going through some things, and I really needed to be out of myself and to be of service. And I'm going to tell you what, I didn't feel like to go into that jail meeting, and I didn't, you know, but at the same sense, I knew that that's where I needed to be. And I got there, you know, and we talked about some stuff, and, you know, half of them in there are looking at the other men and looking around, but there's one woman in there, and she seems to want this thing, and she and I just talked, and it was just like when I left, I felt better about what I was going through. I hope I shared some kind of hope with her. I think I may have, because she's wrote me and she's asked me to sponsor her, and she identified with me. And I think that that's the main thing here, is the identification. That, you know, one alcoholic talking to another, and we need to identify. And if I really can't identify with your feelings, or, you know, you're talking about other things and, you know, other stuff, believe it or not, you know, so many people say today that more people that come to AA today have tried other things, and it's more people that use drugs and stuff. But you know what? There are still people that have just drank and not done these other things. And I want to be sure that I carry a singleness of purpose message, that I may have done those other things, but I'm not going to talk about them in a meeting. Because for me, when I drank, and those other things did come along, after they was gone, I still could not quit drinking. And that's why I know I'm an alcoholic and I'm not nothing else. Even though some of those things were there. And I'm not here to debate about that or anything, but I need to be able to talk with somebody that when I say I did such and this is how I felt, and you can say, oh, well, yeah, and we get that connection. You know, if you're in here just talking about shooting up heroin and I'm talking about drinking and that ain't been my experience and you drink a beer once a year, I don't think we're going to have, I'm just using that as an example, but I don't think we're going to have much identification on that. Maybe someone else, but and you get a lot of that in the jail meeting because there's no NA meetings in there and they all send them to the one meeting. And I try not to debate about it, but I just try to stick to singleness of purpose and keep it back, you know, keep it back to a beginner meeting and what we are and what we're not. And it has saved my life more than, it has saved me so many times. I've got a good life today. Got married in sobriety, had an AA wedding. I never really thought that, you know, I figured I'd just wait tables or my first regular job in AA, I just want to share, was 4 years at an electronics company, and they took a chance on me, and I learned how to build electronics board and soldering and stuff like that. And then, as you know, the electronics business kind of went bad, and I got laid off. But those people give me a chance, and I had a terrible work record. And it was a good family atmosphere, and it was just, I had no experience of sitting down at a desk for 8 hours and doing something, but they didn't care if you listened to a radio or headphones. So the AA tapes is what saved me. When I would want to get up and move around or squirm or leave or somebody was saying something, I had these tapes to listen to, and that just kept me in the seat and kept going. I had no experience. I'd never even worked a job a year, ever. I'm 43 years old. And so I appreciated that. And after that, we got married during that time, and I got me a paper route job. And the reason I got the paper route job was because I wanted to figure out something that I could do. And paper route was kind of like you do it early mornings, you're done with it, you got the rest of your day, and it's not too bad of a money. I do it right in my neighborhood. It takes me an hour during the week, an hour and a half on Sunday. It is a 7-day-a-week job. But that left me time to go to school or to figure out to do. So during that time, and I still have the paper route job, I took a class on real estate, and now I'm a realtor in Lynchburg. I have 3 keys to 3 offices where I never could be trusted with money or anything before. And these guys, even though I passed the real estate class, which took 3 times on the test, I still had to go before a state board in Richmond. The DPOR, you have to go before them, you know, and if you have felonies and you have different things, it's kind of hard. But I come to find out later on, which is really weird, not during the time, but later on, it's a 7-member board, and one of us is on that board. One of us is on that board, and I didn't know that before, and I didn't ask for no special favors, but my boss told me that one of them was on that board and even offered me the phone number and said, you know, you might want to just give him a call and fill him out and let him know where you're at. And I said, no, I don't need that number. I'm going to go in there and share, you know, when they ask me about such and such, I'm going to be truthful with them. And I was truthful, and I didn't know if I got the license, and they sent it to me. So I just believe that so many good things has happened to me. Everything that's good and decent in my life today started when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous with not really wanting to quit drinking. I wanted to quit suffering. I wanted y'all to help me out. I was still scheming and manipulating again. But somehow or another, somebody, through the man at the Elks Lodge asking me to go to a meeting and putting the AA thing in my mind and somehow or another calling for the wrong motives, I got into this thing. And y'all led me to a God that I've got in my life today that I really don't understand. I'm in that process, but I know it works. I know that everything that people have told me here, that if I'll take action and actually do, has worked. It may not have worked out exactly the way I've wanted it, but it's worked. And I don't crave a drink today. The book talks about it'll come a time and place, you know, when nothing will stand between you and a drink but your God. That's happened to me. I know I'm in a place of neutrality. I know I'm safe and protective. Now, my behavior is another thing. I got behavior problems. I'm still rough around the edges, and you know what? That's okay, too, because I'm not a finished product of my God. And I try not to hurt anybody on purpose. Sometimes this mouth overloads me. I try to make amends. But when all else fails and I don't get to a meeting and the praying, I don't know, the phone will ring or I'll get a letter or somebody will need a ride or the jail meeting or somebody, that one-on-one talking and contact, that saves me every time. And I was talking with somebody, you know, and I was saying, you know, I know things may be a little uncomfortable, you know, right now with some stuff I'm going through. And she said, Kelly, it ain't about comfortability. It ain't about being comfortable. She said, sometimes we need to be uncomfortable. And I thought, oh, God, another growing experience. But, you know, it's going to be all right. It's going to be all right. I know that everything's going to be all right as long as I keep suiting up and showing up here, as long as I try to extend my hand. as long as I go back and try to make amends, and if I don't pick up a drink, I mean, I'm not going to stand here and tell you that I'm not immune to a drink. If I quit coming around here and I quit praying, you know, and my life is going good, and yeah, I'm making a little bit of money now, and I don't need, you know, and I, you know, there's going to come a time, too, where I might just be around, you know, I'm around a lot of business people, and they do drink. I might think if they hand me one that it's okay to take one. You know, because I know I only get that daily reprieve for today. And I don't want to never think that I'm so far into this and so up there that I could never take a drink, because they still say, if it's true, 35% of us in this room right now and throughout are going to die drunk. That's me drunk. That's me included. I hope not. But that's the statistics, that even people, you know, we're going to... So I just want to keep coming. I want to keep coming. Y'all have given me a life. I mean, I didn't even have a life before. I go through things, but my first response is not to take a drink. My first response usually is to talk to another AA member and hit my knees and then take some sort of action and just try to get through the day and be of some kind of help and get out of myself. That just seems to work for me. And it seems to be that every time that I'm about ready to throw the towel in, that I've just had it and it's just too much. And, you know, it always comes back to, you need to look at you. And I'm so sick of hearing that, like, don't somebody else need to look at them? And I'm about ready at that brink. God will put someone in my life or some kind of a message or some kind of a reason to let me keep putting that foot in front of the other. And that's how I get to stay sober, and I've been talked enough. But if you're new tonight, or, you know, you want a different way of life, or you're just tired of being sick, we do have a solution here. And I'm not going to tell you that it's going to be all lovey-dovey at first, because it's not. It's going to be real uncomfortable, but if I take some actions here, I know that I'm guaranteed to be safe and protected. If I stick close to my God, perform His work well, try to help other people, you know, try my best to change what I can and what I can't, just let God do it in His time, because He's not done, I'm going to be okay. And I know I'm not going to take a drink for the rest of tonight. And then tomorrow I'll get up, I'll get on my knees, there's prayers I say, and I go throughout the day. That's just what I do for myself. Thank y'all for letting me share.